Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today I'm having one of my favorite guests on, somebody who's challenging, insightful, and speaks his mind. And I think we need that in this day and age where people are self-censoring and watching everything they say. Not that it helps anyway, because if someone thinks that you said something a certain way, they may come after you. I don't think it's helping us. I think it's making us anxiety-ridden. It's messing with our quality of life, our family, our friends. And unfortunately, it's empowering entities that want to divide and conquer. It's not winning, it's losing. So today I want to have Mr. Matthew Vadim come on. He is an awesome writer, and he's a journalist, an investigative journalist. He is the former senior vice president and senior fellow at Capital Research Center, which is a conservative think tank in Washington, D.C. His work has been cited on multiple platforms, including World News Daily, National Review, Weekly Standard, Wall Street Journal. He's also an adjunct scholar at the James Madison Institute. He's written hard-hitting reports that has changed political fortunes and political destiny of certain things, especially an example in Florida, where the legislator in 2010 was going to pass a bill which was outlawed, thwarting the power of ACORN. This is somebody who's not afraid to speak truth to power. And that's what we need right now. I'm tired of people kowtowing and being mealy-mouthed. This is not a show that wants to do that. And Mr. Vadim is the perfect guest for this. So Mr. Vadim, thank you so much for coming on. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Well, let's start with you wrote a couple of articles, and I think that they're extremely timely. The education system is, I don't know if you can even call it education anymore, whether that's from grade school, but specifically college. I remember when I went, you could say what you thought, you could cite your source. It was about debate, and it was about not everybody pulling the same line and not everybody saying, if you don't agree with me, then you're the worst person in the world. It was different then. Now it seems to be cancel culture 24/7. And you wrote an article called Remote Learning Advances Cancel Culture. I want to discuss that because I don't think parents, in my opinion, I don't think they know exactly what's going on. But I would think when you send your child to school, you're thinking that they're learning and they're actually gaining skills. And I don't know if that's really happening anymore.
Well, you're referring to the article I wrote, Remote Learning Advances Cancel Culture, report says, that was in September 13 online in the Epoch Times. And the point of the piece was that a report came out from the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, or ACTA is their acronym. And they said that the sudden widespread adoption of virtual education has worsened the free speech crisis on college campuses, further limited diversity of viewpoints, and encouraged more self-censorship among students. And it, you know, talks about how schools are terrified now of being ridiculed on Twitter or in memes on Facebook or Instagram or what have you. They don't like little embarrassing reports coming out and going viral about what's going on in on their campuses. And they're quite likely to just, you know, fire people or discipline them without giving them due process or even really thinking very much about it. And so that's what the report from the American Council of Trustees and Alumni said. And they said that all of this has been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic, which has, you know, which has in a way limited the exchange of ideas and made it more difficult for people to express themselves, you know, in addition to isolating people and making, you know, promoting loneliness and so on, and taking away valuable classroom experiences. So, you know, it's online learning has empowered activists to go after the schools and what they're teaching. And this report views that as largely a bad thing. And I don't actually agree with that point. I think it, in many ways, in many circumstances, can be a very good thing, because what schools pump out nowadays, both K-12 and the universities, is, you know, Marxist indoctrination. So calling them out and catching them red-handed espousing these things is a good thing. And I think that this, it has probably led to more good than bad, though I can see the potential for someone, you know, to be ousted for, you know, expressing a completely innocuous viewpoint in a university lecture, you know, like a professor mm-hmm. saying something that should be regarded as factual, but because it doesn't comport with wokeness or political correctness, the person is ridiculed and hounded out of his or her position. So, but I think on balance that this has been empowering, because it allows parents and other people to keep tabs on what their children are learning in K-12 schools and in universities. So I don't think it's an entirely it's as bad a thing as the ACTA report depicts it. So those are my sort of mavericky thoughts on that topic.
Well, from my standpoint, it seems like what you're saying about parents finally getting involved and making statements is finally coming online, but they're playing catch up. I don't see any of these universities stopping their curricula. I don't see them not censoring their students because of someone getting their feelings hurt. And I'd like to see that pendulum really swing all the way. I mean, they're getting a lot of money. It's always follow the money, in my opinion. So these universities are getting so much money from the government, right? You know, they're all concerned about their reputation. But as it comes down to it,
so many of them are so wealthy, like Harvard and Yale. They're basically, what was it? Somebody used a great phrase. I don't know if it was in the Wall Street Journal or something recently. Described them as, you know, hedge funds with classrooms. you know, they have so many billions of dollars saved up. You know, for what reason? They don't spend it on students.
No.
You know, they just amass these. They're these great repositories of wealth. And meanwhile, college tuition keeps going up. It's like in the 50,000s per year at a place like George Washington University, which is a decent university, but is, you know, not a top tier university. And yet they're charging top tier prices. So you have to wonder about that. There's so much money involved. Universities aren't going to change unless that money, unless that cash flow is threatened. And a good way to threaten that cash flow is by holding them accountable. And that means that, you know, pro-American people who are supportive of a pro-American education and parents and so on have to be more active as the activists than the activists on the other side, the leftists and the communists and the people who support critical race theory and who want to divide us and tear this nation down and say, you know, with the racist idea that, you know, that whiteness is that whiteness, whatever that means, is a bad thing, and that white people are racist, and because America is founded by white people, mm-hmm. therefore it's racist and corrupt and, you know, irredeemably evil and all this sort of crap that I find it hard to believe this stuff is taken seriously, and yet it is. And fighting back is the best way to curb these things.
Well, let's talk about critical race theory, because again, it's not something that I, when I was in school, had any concept of, to tell you the truth. And I want to discuss that because it's something that's timely, and I think people need to understand it so they can mount a defense against it. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living a Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Matthew Vadim. And before the break, you were eloquent and passionate about, I think, abuse in the college and educational system. It's torturing people. You can't change something about your innate being, how you look, what color you are. And people are assigning value to skin color, the most arbitrary thing that you can possibly assign. So I'm curious, where did this come from? This came out to me really just out of the blue within the last couple of years. Who started it? Is it, I know it's a Marxist ideology, or at least I think it is. And I know it's about divide and conquer, but how did it come online? How did it get so empowered where teachers are doing it? The school boards are espousing it. There must be, again, some money behind this to do this.
Well, I think it comes out of the critical race theory. One of the originators of it, and there are a few that are claimed to be its founders, but one of the big ones was Derrick Bell, a professor at Harvard Law School, who was beloved by Barack Obama. Barack Obama considered him to be a mentor. And Derrick Bell said that it was his, he was a black man, and I think he's been dead for quite a few years, but his idea, he loved to antagonize white people. He thought it was the most satisfying thing he could possibly do. And he helped to develop this thing, this critical race theory, which is one strain of critical theory. The idea is with critical theory, you criticize something in order to tear it down. And so there was critical legal studies, and that examined the American legal system, which contends is rigged in favor of the wealthy and white people and what have you. Mm-hmm. And then there's a spinoff there, the critical race theory, which basically took the same sort of views and just, grafted race onto it. And America's, racial history, such as its having slavery when the country was founded, but then it got rid of slavery, but apparently that wasn't enough for these left-wing, these communists and Marxist agitators. It wasn't enough that got rid of it. And they argue that this racism or white supremacy, they call it, which strikes me as kind of odd-sounding. You'd think they'd call it white supremacism, but anyway, they talk about how white supremacy is deeply embedded in our culture, in American culture, and that it is the root of all, or maybe depending on who you're talking to, most of the evils of prevalent in American society today. And they think that all of this, any problems that America has today or that it's ever had at bottom come from the racial problems in the past. And that we have to, there's all sorts of things we have to do to remedy that. We have to give reparations for slavery to people who were never slaves, and take the money from people who were never slaveholders. Because all the people who may have wronged other people are dead, and all the people who may have been wronged by slavery are also dead. So reparations is just sort of a weird giveaway to a political constituency it's a way of buying their votes. Mm-hmm. And the Democratic Party is, I wouldn't say it's that there's a complete support for it in the Democratic Party, but there's a lot more support nowadays than there used to be for it. Because they've been taken over by this wokeness crap. Since 2015, the Democratic Party has been a backer of the Black Lives Matter movement, which, apart from having a nice name, because who can deny that Black Lives Matter? Of course, all lives matter. Mm-hmm. But they endorsed the Black Lives Matter movement back in 2015 in a Democratic National Committee resolution. And this was when Black Lives Matter was talking about the same things they talk about nowadays, that police engage in extrajudicial executions of Black people on a routine basis. And that's just pure fantasy. It's not true. If anything, it can be argued that in many situations, Black people are treated more leniently by the police because of the so-called Ferguson effect, which, again, something the left calls it a myth, but it's not a myth. And police officers are very reluctant to do what needs to be done nowadays if the suspect or if the perpetrator is Black, because they're afraid there will be blowback against them. And this is hurting Black communities most of all, because the police are, you know, increasingly unwilling to patrol them and to take on and investigate perpetrators who are Black. So it's had this, you know, weird spillover, unintended effect, that all this sensitivity about, you know, Black people and race consciousness has had this unanticipated, I guess, side effect of putting them in a worse situation than they were before. And if there have been polls of Black Americans, and they pretty consistently don't support the crazy ideas like defunding the police. If anything, what's his name? The big, he's got the big movie studio, Tyler Perry, mm-hmm. has said, puts out a lot of interesting movies and whatever. He's a movie making and TV program making powerhouse. And he says, if any, we don't want to defund the police. If anything, we want more police. We need them to protect the community. So there's this weird Marxist inversion that's gone on, where the police are now bad. You've got police kneeling and asking for forgiveness, as they did at the height of the Black Lives Matter riots in 2020, after the death in Minneapolis police custody of George Floyd. And, police are pretty consistently picked out as the bad guys. They were talking for a while about, I think they backed away from the stupid idea, but they were talking for a while about canceling the very popular show Law and Order, mm-hmm. because it was too pro-cop. And I think they did cancel the show Cops, because it portrayed the cops as being the good guys and dealing with criminals and lowlifes and, going out in the field and arresting them and investigating, you know, meth labs and domestic disturbances and what have you. So this backlash against the police, caused by all this wokeness, has done nothing but hurt society, especially the people that these activists claim to want to help.
But let's think about this.
Does that make sense to you?
It makes absolute sense. But I think there's a bigger picture. There's a corporatization of this. And you just described the average person is not in alignment with this because it affects their bottom line. I remember watching these riots go on, and Black-owned businesses, small business owners were having their places looted and burnt out. And nobody, and if this system or that particular ideology cared about the people who are on the lower end of the economic stratus, or if you wanted to just do Black people, whatever, they didn't give a damn about them. They just were grist for the mill, just ran over them. And what? So this
they're cannon fodder in the revolution.
Absolutely. And this whole thing is completely hypocritical. What's laughable to me is that the people who are the highest, the loudest voices are sitting in ivory tower colleges, and they're mostly white people. So it's bizarre on so many levels. And it's almost like it's a duality where the majority of society who get along with each other, who go to work and play with each other to, interact, are completely averse to this. They just kind of, it's a parallel thing, but the media and the corporatization of it make it seem like it's a big, huge amount of people. And it's actually not, is it?
Well, I think there are a lot of people out there who support Black Lives Matter, but I think that they are, and Antifa and so on, but I think that they are a minority, but they are a vocal, angry, aggressive minority, and they have very good PR. They managed to convince the media and other dupes and useful idiots that they have much broader support in society than they actually do have. So, that's what helps keep them going is this perception of popular sympathy for this kind of thing.
But see, we're going to take a break in a couple of minutes, but I want to put the thought or the thesis out. This is a corporate-driven system, whether it's healthcare, whether it's big business, big tech. It's the corporations who want to destroy the individual, the small, the people who actually have a skill and actually know how to use it. So if you damage society and you break it up, who stands to gain? It's the big corporate interests. That's what it seems to me. Otherwise, what is the point of Coke and all these other people, all these other corporations jumping on the bandwagon of Antifa and Black Lives Matter and ridiculous whole, PR campaigns that are technically have ruined their brand? Here in Coke, in Georgia, Coke has not recovered from their little fiasco where they were trying to tell.
Are you talking about Coca-Cola, not the Coke brothers?
Oh, no, not the Coke brothers.
Coca-Cola. Not the Coke brothers.
No, sir.
Okay.
But I mean, they.
And Coca-Cola should not recover.
No,
what a terrible
they're not.
Company.
I agree. And if you walk through the supermarkets, there's Coke products on the yin yang where that was never the case. So again, it's like these universities.
I've been drinking Diet Pepsi for a long time now.
Well, I'm in Georgia, right? So Coke was the thing down here. So let's.
Well, you can't even think about it. All soda is Coke. isn't that true? You go into a restaurant in Georgia and you say,
"Yeah,
I want some Coke." They say, "Yes, we'll get you some Coke. What kind?"
Well, you can't ask for Pepsi. That's for sure.
Which you could ask for a Pepsi or a root beer.
Well, you can't down here, but you may get a side eye. But let's take our second break because I want to explore that when we come back. You're Living in the Solution.
You're listening to Living in the Solution with Dr. Lana George, Consumer Healthcare Advocate. If you miss Living in the Solution, you can catch it on drlanagegeorge.com, YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, and a host of multimedia platforms. You can follow her on Positive Solutions on Telegram and Living in the Solution on Facebook. Subscribe and share it with your friends.
Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Matthew Vadim. And the Epoch Times, you write for them, and people can, if they want to go to the Epoch Times or Epoch Times and look up your name, is that the best place to see everything you've written?
Yeah, well, I also post them at my personal website, which is MatthewVadim.com. I'll spell that MatthewVadim, MatthewVadim.com. I repost all of the articles I write. I also write a lot for Front Page magazine of the David Horowitz Freedom Center, though I haven't written for them in a few weeks, but I will be writing again for them a whole bunch of articles soon. I just have had other things on the front burner. Occasionally I write for the American Spectator and haven't written much for them in a while, but I do plan to write more for them in the future. So, but you can find it all at MatthewVadim.com.
And people listen to him and read what he's written because it's eye-opening and it just gives you a different frame of reference. Everything, I don't even watch the news anymore. It's not possible to watch it. But prior to the break, I was trying to really get a handle on the fact that there's so much money floating around. There's so much corporate, well, it's fascism because it's public-private partnerships, and they can care less if people
right.
withdraw.
By definition, a public-private partnership is fascism.
Mm-hmm.
The economic expression of it, which is called corporatism, and I really don't like it when people misuse the word corporatism or corporatist nowadays. You know, if something comes from a corporation, that doesn't mean it's necessarily corporatist. Corporatism is the merger of state and corporate power, and it's fascism, and it's generally, accept, I guess, for the occasional tax-exempt municipal bonds issued to build a highway like the Pocahontas Parkway in Richmond, Virginia, I'd say it's generally a bad thing to have corporations and the government working together.
I would agree with that. And it seems like it's this monolithic machine that keeps the status quo at, you know, by any means necessary. If you're looking at the internet, for example, and what's gone on in the last, forever it seems, but several years, big tech has become completely unhinged. It's censorship city. If you have a platform, I've seen so many people lose their platforms from YouTube, from anything that they have a power behind. They can just censor you, and people don't even know. They don't have an opposite view of anything now. It's only one story that's being given, no matter what it is. And it's affecting our ability to be free. And if that's tied to education, and it's tied to social media, and it's tied to everything that we access, thinking that we're able to put our voices out, or we're listening to voices that are free, when in actuality they may be influencers or some entity that's being an offshoot of this machine, how do we take our power back? I mean, how do we become discerning about what we're consuming?
It's not an easy question to answer. But it is clear that corporations are not necessarily a bad thing, but when they are tied in with the government, they tend to do bad things. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Silicon Valley and big tech in what we used to call high tech, but just big tech, and the ways that they conspire against the average person every day now. You know, you have them doing the bidding of the government in censoring people, because Joe Biden is fine with people being censored. Joe Biden, illegitimate fake president. I like to refer to him as POTUS 46 asterisk when I write about him sometimes. They do the bidding of these leftists and these government officials who don't want alternative views heard. On whether it's on the treatment of COVID-19 or vaccine mandates or vaccination mandates or anything like that. They suppress people. They suppress opinions that they don't approve of. And, you know, what makes, how is it that we're to know that the 12-year-old electronic sweatshop workers in Malaysia who moderate content for Facebook, I'm afraid I might not be. Anyway, why should we believe that they're more enlightened and that they're in a better position to judge what opinions and what facts we should be allowed to consume than we are? And this heavy-handedness, we did not see that with Facebook and with Instagram and even Twitter until President Donald Trump became popular and was actually elected to office. And then all of a sudden, big tech overnight became this authoritarian monolith, which would not allow dissenting views. Like, what if you say that what happened January 6, 2021 at the United States Capitol was not an armed insurrection, you're going to get blocked. You're going to get shadow banned by Twitter and Facebook and the like, even though it is a perfectly reasonable opinion. Well, and it's a fact that it was not an armed insurrection because they didn't find a single gun on any of the people who were, arrested. So, if it was an insurrection, I don't know what it was with. Was it with slingshots, maybe, or, with selfie sticks? It wasn't an armed insurrection, and they keep calling it that, like it was a coup attempt. No, it was a bunch of angry people blowing off some steam. And maybe they did some things that they shouldn't have, but that doesn't mean that it was an attempt to overthrow the government. You know, mm-hmm. you have to do more than go in and commit petty acts of vandalism and steal, Nancy Pelosi's ceremonial lectern and put your feet up on her desk and take, you know, pictures of it to overthrow the government. You can't, you know, it's not that easy in a vast country like America, which has about a third of a billion people. This is not Dominica, West Indies, where you grab the main radio station and you have a few guys with machine guns and you've taken over the country. It doesn't work that way.
Well, I mean,
big tech, it works against the American people, and it's never been more obvious since the Trump era began.
But how do we, as...
They even banned him. He can't speak. While he was president, they banned him. That's insane.
It is insane. But how do we move or defang this? I think there's people who have started an alternate pathway. People are talking about a second internet. There's certain platforms that are, you know, freestanding, Telegram, Gab, whatever.
I think we have to use the legal system against them, because in the foreseeable future, Facebook is not going away as an agenda setting social media website. So we have to fight it using the legal system. For example, John Hinderacher, the president of the Center for the American Experiment in Minnesota, has come up with a very interesting idea. I wrote about it in the Epoch Times a few weeks ago, and that is that you should use the laws against discrimination to level the playing field with Facebook and other social and Twitter and other social media outfits. If they ban somebody with a certain point of view, look at what the people with the opposite point of view have and see if they were banned and if the treatment of those people differed significantly from your own side, then you may be able to make a case that you have been unlawfully discriminated against. And people should just start burying social media in lawsuits. Just sue the hell out of them. And make their lives, I know they got more money than God, but you know, you can still make their lives miserable, and you can still make it difficult for them to do business. There also may be, you know, benefits to changing Section 230 of the Decency in Communications Act, which it's not something a lot of people understand, but it shields the big tech companies from liability for messages expressed on their platforms. And you know, the social media outfits took that as a license to start censoring everybody when, you know, that it doesn't even make sense. They don't, mm-hmm. they don't have to, you know, they're shielded, but, you know, maybe taking away, I don't know if it's a good best policy or not, because it's very complicated and there's lots of things that could go wrong, but, you know, maybe modifying Section 230 or getting rid of it is a good idea. That's a subject for another day, and probably with someone who's more up on tech policy than I am. But in the meantime, you can start to make their lives difficult by filing lawsuits, because they hate that, and they have to respond. And in America, unlike most of the Commonwealth or former, you know, countries founded based upon Anglo-Saxon law, you generally don't have to pay the other side's costs if you lose. So there's no reason not to sue.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Sue the
that.
Hell out of them. Sue the bastards. Okay. And, if you lose, then, you know, go to GoFundMe and raise money to pay your legal bills. But in the meantime, make it so difficult for them to operate. And protest against them, you know, that it makes their lives difficult. I'm not saying everybody should be like Laura Loomer and chain themselves to Twitter's front door as she did in New York City, though I particularly enjoyed that stunt. That was a good thing. It really drew attention to the cause. I'm not saying everybody has to do that, but things like that are actually very helpful. And we can learn from the left how to do these things to attract attention from the media and win sympathy for our cause. And we can do it without hurting people. You see, the difference is the left is fine with hurting people. The left is fine with destroying property and invading people's personal space and, wrecking their businesses and whatever. We don't have to do that. We can use some of their tactics, the ones that work, against them. And I think it's about high time that we did that.
I think that's great food for thought while we take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Matthew Vadim. And, before the break, we were talking about how we can take our power back and play the game better than they do. But is there a road for just withdrawing your consent? Just don't even access the system. It's so corrupt. Why would we even want to be involved with something like a Facebook who just got found out, with child porn and all sorts of stuff? Why do we even need to have this or engage in it? Because if people stopped using it, wouldn't that accomplish the same result?
I suppose it would, but it's going to be really hard to do because not every aspect of Facebook is evil. It's over the last 10 or so years, I've enjoyed, interacting with people and having discussions, even heated discussions, though those become more dangerous now in the era of social media censorship. You have to be careful what you say. Saying it, you can get banned on Twitter for mocking the transgender movement, even though it's totally ridiculous and shouldn't be taken seriously by any thinking person. By saying that a man is a man and a woman is a woman, you can get banned on Twitter, which is totally, totally insane. If you can withdraw from Facebook, great. Now, the downside of that is that you're not in a position to influence them. If you withdraw your consent, then you don't have any pull with them. So if you want to put up stuff, because right now, at least, Facebook allows you to put up things critical of Facebook. If they take down something you posted, you can write about it on Facebook. And, until they start curbing your ability to do that, you can use Facebook to fight Facebook. So if you opt out of it, you're giving up all of your power to influence them. So that's the sort of thing that sounds appealing at first, but, might be counterproductive. I'm not really sure what the best way to proceed is on that, but there are ways to fight them.
Well, I think
I think Twitter though is a totally lost cause because they are so ideologically entrenched and nutty that I don't see any point in even participating on Twitter. But maybe I'm wrong, but I just view it as the place where the kookiest of the kooky woke people hang out. And I was banned from them like 2 years ago. I don't even remember why I was banned, but I'm sure it was something that was not important, except to a woke person. And it's just a cesspool. Whenever anybody puts up anything, like Congressman Devin Nunes, Republican California, will put up something that makes sense, or Florida Governor Ron DeSantis will put up something that makes sense, and they're immediately savaged by this angry pack of leftist hyenas who seem to have nothing better to do than spread their hateful thoughts and ideology, And it's just Twitter, you know, used to be kind of fun. You know, they'd have like games where you could participate, where, you know, you change one name in a movie's title and, you know, and it'd be funny. And they'd have things like that. But Twitter has become very serious and ideological in recent years. And if you're on the wrong side, if you're going against the powers that be at Twitter, you're not going to be able to thrive there, and you're probably going to get banned as soon as you step out of line. And stepping out of line is very easy to do when you're dealing with the Nimrods at Twitter.
But isn't this all coming full circle back to the college level, where kids are self-censoring and they're afraid to speak up in class because they might anger the professor, or you've had people have their grades changed? It's the same thing. I mean, it's almost like a platform where this negative energy gets magnified. And who even knows if the people that are coming after you, for example, were people, or were they bots from the computer? Were they algorithm driven? You know, it's almost like it's this entity that's driving people down a path to either feel bad about themselves, to pick a side and become tribalized. But it all comes down to being virtual, right? So if you're spending all your time
being virtuous or virtual?
Virtual. Because you're not spending any time making changes in the real world, like you described, suing people, getting out there where you hit them in the pocketbook, where you're actually physically present. It's great to spout off online when no one can see you. You could talk all sorts of nonsense, but are you really actually making a difference? And maybe that's the point, huh? Where you're so busy, you know, standing your ground virtually, that you're not making any difference. I mean, Facebook is getting money from some other source, obviously. They could care less what goes on. And they're immune. This is another little thing that seems to be pervading. These fascist, corporatist, this whole system is based on immunity. No one ever has to, you know, pay for what they do to people. You know, people hurt themselves after being told to hurt themselves online. Nothing happens to the person who puts it out there, and so on and so forth. Maybe it's time we disengage so that we can actually come into the real world, and then people can actually have consequences.
Well, yeah, I you know, people probably do spend too much time online nowadays, and you know, I myself plead guilty. Throw the cuffs on me. you know, probably because I'm an information junkie, so it's pretty hard for me not to spend a lot of time online. It's social media gives people an outlet they would otherwise not have, but mm-hmm. it also, people, you know, become obsessed with it, and they spend like their whole day on it, and it becomes their whole lives. And that's really, you know, sad and pathetic.
Well, I think it's a tool, isn't it? It's an instrument. You're using it to educate people and to jog us into, you know, shake us into reality that, hey, this is something, these are bigger pieces that you're falling into, and you're being used, right? So I think we wouldn't have a podcast, right? A radio show if the internet was so awful, because it's a way to communicate with people, to go, to break through the fog. But you just described prior to the break, if this is a problem, you need to actually make changes that to break this paradigm. If that means suing people, if that means being able to find like-minded people that can fight this narrative, whatever the narrative is. And hopefully at some point, you know, I don't know if it's going to be possible, but in your experience, do you find that people are, they see the censorship and then they question it? Are they saying to themselves, you know, they have to work so hard to shut this, whatever the narrative is, off, maybe I should start doing some research into it. Is that happening?
I think it happens to an extent, but only with people who are, you know, motivated to do something about it. You know, most people right now, you know, if there's fact checking, they're probably inclined to believe it. They're probably inclined to trust an authority figure like that when they really shouldn't. But yes, it does generate some resistance, some pushback when people see that. When I see it, you know, I'm naturally skeptical of that sort of thing. And, you know, as a journalist, I guess I'm in the right profession to be like that. So it does motivate some people to do something, though with others it doesn't. So I don't know. It might be kind of, it might be a wash. I'm not sure.
Interesting. I hope more people come to our side of thinking. You know, if there's a, someone's trying to squash an opinion, I want to know why. And if you really are on the good side or the right side or telling the truth, there's only one truth. So you shouldn't be afraid for people to question it or have an alternative opinion, because the truth will win out. So, I mean,
I hope it will.
It will. It will. It always does. So in the minute and a half we have left, please let people know how they can find you, read your articles, and support you.
Well, you can read me at the Epoch Times and frontpagemag.com. And you can read, I repost everything I write pretty well at matthewvadum.com, MatthewVadum.com. And I'm not on Twitter because I got banned. So screw you, Twitter. I do have a Facebook page with a few hundred followers. You can look it up, Matthew Vadum, V-A-D-U-M. So, but that doesn't, I think that's getting shadow banned, because whenever I put up something, it never seems to get more than, you know, 15 people looking at it, which seems suspicious. That so few people would be interested in the topics that I write about, given how, you know, these are things that are completely relevant nowadays and pretty urgent matters. So, yeah, that's how you stay in touch with what I'm writing. Is it's best at my website, matthewvadum.com. And, you know, subscribe to the Epoch Times. It's a great newspaper.
I agree. I love it. It's always something refreshing and a different take. And it's not, it's just the facts, right? It's not this drum filled, trying to make me,
right.
Influence me to think a certain way.
But we cover things that the other media don't. And I think that's what, quite apart from us trying our best to be objective, I think that's what we do really well, is we focus on stories that are of interest to Americans, and we don't just, you know, spoon feed them what they want to hear.
We need more of you out there, that's for sure. So I want to thank you so much for your time. Yeah. I can't wait to have you back on. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, sure. No problem, Doctor.
Well, I hope you have a wonderful day, and I want to thank everybody for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.